Marcos. The next and last presentation is by me. I am, again, Rick Brown, the director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research and principal investigator of the California Health Interview Survey. And therefore, I guess I do have a conflict of interest to report, but it's not a commercial one. As PI of CHIS, of course, I am likely to say things that you might want to take with a grain of salt, but we will be providing some evidence related to what I will be talking about. I'd like to first start off by thanking my collaborators in this effort, colleagues at the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, Dr. Breen at the National Cancer Institute, and Dr. Barry Portnoy at the Office of Disease Prevention at NIH, all of whom participated in the design, implementation, or interpretation of this study that I will be presenting. The focus of my presentation is on translating research into policy in order to improve health. And our objective in the center that I direct is to really help promote the development of evidence-based health policy. And the objective of that is that providing evidence-based health policy has the best opportunity to actually improve the health of communities and populations. But as we see it, one of the first tasks is to actually give the data tools, the evidentiary tools, to the people who are in a position to make these kinds of changes to improve health, specifically policymakers and advocates. We tried to develop a strategic approach to doing this by, one, making research findings and data accessible to policymakers and advocates, but then beyond that, not only accessible in terms of getting their hands on data, but there's the issue of analysis, which I'd like to talk about very briefly, and that is that in the university, research organizations, other places, we have the technical capacity to do analyses with data. But many local health departments lack that capacity, and certainly many community-based organizations, community agencies, community clinics obviously lack that kind of capacity. So one of our tools, our goals, was to democratize access to analysis and application of data, as well as to the data itself, and to do that for policymakers and advocates, particularly those with less technical capacity. The audiences that we identify as relevant for this effort include policymakers who are in government agencies or in legislatures at the state or local level or at the federal level. Policy entrepreneurs who are champions of an issue, who will take that issue, whether they're inside government or outside of government, and try to drive it to a policy change. Advocates who, from the outside, are trying to influence policy and outcomes. And leaders of community-based organizations and agencies, like community clinics or community health programs. They may be community-based mammography programs or women's health programs that are seeking to improve the health of the communities that they represent or serve. And finally, news, media, and journalists who have the ability to greatly expand the reach of our evidence. These I talked a little about the barriers some of these people face, but clearly policymakers and their staffs have very limited technical resources or time with which to do analyses of data or even access existing data. Advocates, especially those for low-income populations, have very few technical resources at their disposal. Even local health departments and community-based agencies, as I talked about before. And many local jurisdictions and many populations of color have very limited data available about their populations at all. And that was one of the main things that CHIS was designed to try to overcome. So we have developed a strategy to try to address these issues and further this goal of injecting evidence-based information into the policy process by first developing population-based data that can inform the policy process. Secondly, by encouraging policy-focused research by university researchers and to provide relevant data from them into the policy process. Third, not only having them do this policy-focused research, but then taking the results of that and not merely publishing it in peer-reviewed journals, which, while important, are very unlikely to move from there into the community, but rather to develop direct researcher-to-policy audiences, channels of communication and dissemination that can respond to their needs. Fourth, providing free access to data and to very easy-to-use analytic tools. And you'll see some of those that we have attempted to develop. And finally, helping advocates and local health departments enhance their capacity to effectively use data and research. The center is home to the California Health Interview Survey, which it conducts in partnership and collaboration with the California Department of Public Health, the Department of Healthcare Services, and the Nonprofit Public Health Institute. And Dr. Mark Horton, the director of the California Department of Public Health, is with us this afternoon. CHIS is a population-based health survey that's designed to provide information about diverse population groups and geographic areas, as Dr. Breen described in her presentation. I'll go over that pretty lightly. We have conducted four surveys so far, and for the first three, the data are already out in use in California and elsewhere. We provide statistically adequate samples for most counties in California, 41 counties. The remaining 17 counties are in three different county groupings, and they are the smallest counties in the state. We also provide statistically adequate samples for key ethnic and racial groups, including Asian and Latino subgroups, a number of each. And the survey is comprehensive in its approach. We cover health care access, health insurance coverage, health behaviors, mental health, chronic disease, and a variety of other topics. And the survey, as Dr. Sharif Marcos pointed out, is conducted in six languages. CHIS was developed through a very participatory process that we regard as very important, and each cycle of CHIS is similarly planned with a very formal participation involving about 160 people from about 60 different organizations in more than a dozen different formal advisory bodies. This is a stakeholder process that informs the content of what we cover in the survey, some of the sample design as well. And I think in other surveys we see less of that kind of participation, which I think often inhibits the relevance of their ultimate data to these stakeholder groups. A second characteristic of CHIS is that we put extensive investment into dissemination. We invest approximately $1 out of $5 that we raise for each cycle of CHIS into dissemination. And as far as I know, there are not any other surveys that put that kind of investment into getting the data out and into the hands of people who may actually use it. One of the tools that we use to get data out are policy maker friendly publications like these policy briefs, which some of you may have seen. They're available on our website as well. But we also invest a lot in our website as a vehicle of disseminating information. It's the key vehicle by which people can get access to any information at all about the survey. We get on average, about 21,000 unique visitors each month to our CHIS website. Our center website gets about double that. We have also developed an online free data query system called Ask CHIS. How many of you have tried Ask CHIS? So this is already a crowd I'm preaching to, the choir here. But it's really a very easy-to-use query system, very fast, gives you real-time analyses to your tailored data requests. We have over 17,000 registered users who've made more than 300,000 queries. And finally, we invest in electronic data files, which we make available as public use files on our website, free, easily downloaded, with methodology reports and guidance on how to use the data. We also provide technical assistance from staff in the center. And we have a data access center where people can come, qualified researchers can come to use confidential data files. And last, we also, with the support of a variety of funding partners, conduct workshops to help enhance community capacity and encourage them to use the data. But we wanted to know, does all this really amount to anything? Does all of this expenditure of resources really result in anything specific? And how do we know it? So we set about trying to measure that and to understand how agencies and organizations utilize, access and use CHIST data. To do this, we designed a two-stage study, and we have completed phase one, which is a qualitative stage. That was funded by the National Cancer Institute and the NIH Office of health, health promotion, disease prevention. Thank you. And that phase has been completed. The next phase, which is being funded by the California Endowment, is now underway. For phase one, we drew a sample of organizations that were known to us to be CHIST data users in one way or another. They were on our listserv, they were AskCHIS registered users, or they accessed public use data files. We interviewed 29 organizations. They included state and local government legislative representatives and agencies, nonprofit organizations, and some commercial organizations in healthcare as well. And then we conducted more in-depth interviews with seven of these. I'm just going to very briefly summarize our findings in this, and we have a short report which we'd be glad to send you if you want to request it following this. CHIST data were used extensively in California's recent and failed healthcare reform attempt. CHIST data were not the cause of the failure. But in fact, they actually facilitated the dialogue that occurred around healthcare reform in California. And the reason I say that is that the governor set the pattern by using CHIST data and requiring a contracted modeler, that is, Jonathan Gruber at MIT, who was contracted by the California Healthcare Foundation to model the different proposals for healthcare reform, required that he use CHIST data as well. Legislative leaders also used CHIST data in crafting their alternative approaches, and that included not only the Democratic leadership, but the Republican leadership as well. CHIST data were used by the Senate Health Committee in their assessments of different kinds of proposals that were coming before them. And in addition to that, CHIST data were used by a variety of advocacy groups and interest groups, those who supported healthcare reform and those who opposed it. So what CHIST became in this was the common data set that basically enabled people to get beyond the question of, well, how many uninsured are there, and how many people who are low income, how many immigrants are there, or undocumented immigrants or illegal immigrants who are uninsured, who would need to be covered or might be left out of any reforms. Incidentally, I will tell you as an anecdote that the use of the CHIST data did in the end also contribute to the failure of healthcare reform, because when in the final stages of this process before the Senate Health Committee, the legislative analyst was asked to do an analysis of the final proposal that was being voted on, she came in and she said, well, we don't know whether CHIST data really have an accurate count of the uninsured. And if the number is higher than they estimate, than CHIST data estimate, then the reform effort, the reform program, will be underfunded and contribute to increased demands on the general fund, which everybody wants to avoid, and will put the reforms out over budget. I don't think that was determinative of the fate of healthcare reform, but it was certainly one factor that probably did contribute to it, and it may be worthy of discussion later on. The California Food Policy Advocates has also used CHIST data in a collaboration with the center on a research brief on food insecurity in California. An article in the LA Times reporting the study findings then prompted an assemblyman member to introduce a bill to increase participation in the food stamp program. That bill passed the legislature, and the CHIST data were seen as a key element in that advocacy process. The California Endowment provides a different kind of example of the use of CHIST data. Here it is for program planning by a major foundation in the state that uses CHIST data in making decisions about where they will invest their resources. The LA Regional Food Bank uses CHIST data both to help figure out where within the county they need to put some of their largest resources, and also to give visibility to the problem in their fundraising efforts. And they use it in a number of other counties as well. CHIST data are also used in program and service planning. Many counties have used CHIST data to develop their public-private partnerships, which provide expanded health insurance coverage for children who do not qualify, uninsured children who do not qualify for the state's Medicaid and SCHIP program. And they use these both for planning the program, for justifying the need for the program, and then also even in their budgeting process. The California Diabetes Program within the state public health department also uses CHIST data in their program planning effort. So I think that what we found in this study was that CHIST data were used in many different ways by organizations and leaders in many different domains in the state. The data are accessed especially through our Ask CHIST query system, which has proven to be an important vehicle for disseminating data and for providing an analytic tool that really does democratize the ability to conduct analyses with data, fairly sophisticated analyses. We have already reviewed the different ways in which stakeholders use CHIST data. Some of the key conclusions, I think, from this are that based on the reports of the people we interviewed, the breadth of information that is contained in CHIST was seen as extremely useful because it enabled CHIST to be applied to a wide range of health issues. The availability of comparable CHIST data at the statewide level and at the local level were also critical to the use of CHIST data, as Dr. Browner's presentation demonstrated. The CHIST sample supports analyses for many racial, ethnic, and other population groups, enabling people to focus on things like racial and ethnic disparities and other kinds of disparities and the particular needs of different population groups, including, for example, we have a very large sample of immigrants, and CHIST data are a valuable tool for understanding the particular needs of the undocumented population, how they differ from the documented immigrant population. Same thing for sexual minorities in California. CHIST data quality was seen as important. The credibility of the data meant that when it was used, it was it didn't generate questions, with the exception of the legislative analyst, as I mentioned before. and then data access, the ability to access the data through multiple channels and methods was also seen as very important to the use of the data by this diverse audience. A number of respondents commented on the importance of the technical support that they did receive in the use of the data. Although we try to make the data very easy to use, nevertheless, somebody trying to take a public use file and apply the weights that are there to the data may be a challenge for some people. Helping them over that hurdle is just one example of where the data do provide that the technical assistance provides value. So, final conclusion, comprehensive topics and comparable state and local population-based health data do provide a useful source of data for policy development, advocacy, and program planning, and the very substantial investment in dissemination and communication related to those data is a key aspect of making the data actually used and giving them impact. Thank you. And I'd like to invite my fellow panelists up so that we can take your questions and any comments you might have. Yes?
Hi. So first of all, I'd just like to say I use CHIS all the time. It's a wonderful source, and we are able to get so much information out of it. As Dr. Browner mentioned, the Native American, American Indian, Native Alaska population, it's really hard for us to generate any information about that population. As well as, we have a lot of interest in subgroup populations, so within Latino and Indian populations, subgroup populations. And so that's kind of just one comment, question about where CHIS is going with that. And as a follow-up, or as a kind of a second question with Dr. Sharif Marco, you mentioned with the version B you asked people, do you have discrimination because you are Latino? And I wonder within subgroups, whether maybe there is racial ethnic discrimination going on, but it may be within the Latino population, people from different subgroups that are feeling discrimination from other members of the same larger subgroup. So.
Sama, would you like to respond? Dr. Smith.
I found these all fascinating theories.
We do have a microphone there if people would not mind using it. That way everybody could hear. Thank you.
I found these all fascinating in various ways. But I'm on a mission. And my mission is to get every speaker to actually cite the question, the survey for which they have provided us with a rate. Okay. With the graph or the rate on which it's based. Which, of course, presents its challenges. You can't have any large tables of numbers anymore because you have to have a question right there as well. But it does seem to me so patently obvious that this is a good thing that I don't think I care to pursue the reasons for it.
Anybody like to respond to that? I'm not sure what the intent of the question was.
This is a mission, not a question.
question.
I see, okay.
It's a comment on several things I've seen.
I see, okay. Thank you. Anybody? Dr. Horton.
Two questions. One, Dr. Browner, what colon screening protocol was asked about in the question? In other words, when you asked them whether they had gotten colorectal cancer screening, what did you ask about? And the second question was, my mind may have been wandering, but I thought I detected some different direction between what Dr. Green presented and what you presented in terms of the impact of having a regular physician or having a regular source of care and its impact on whether they got screened or not. Did I detect that, a difference?
Right. Well, I think what was happening was Dr. Browner was looking at within a single time period, and so she found, which we always find in the literature, that not having a physician, it makes you much less likely to get screened. And what I was looking at was change over time. And so even though we find people without a physician less likely to be screened, we found people who hadn't seen a doctor in the past 12 months, there was a big increase in their use of screening. So you see over time, there was a big increase in their use of screening. And that was, in fact, what was striking about it.
Sure. Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Additionally, we use slightly different data sets. I used the 2003 data set, and I believe you were looking at 2003 and 5. To answer your question about the colorectal cancer screening, I used...
Can you hear Dr. Browner? And Nancy, did you want to report on the measure you used related to mammogram screening in terms of recency of the time?
Yeah, we define recent as having had a mammogram in the past 2 years. So the question was, have you ever had a mammogram, and then what was your most recent mammogram? And there were a range of age categories, and one was within a year, within 2 years. So if they had a mammogram within 2 years or less, and they were considered to have had a recent
cancer.
Yes.
Yeah. I think you'll be able to hear me. Offhand, with regards to the screening data in the Latino population, have you broken it down with regards to age, with regards to screening rates, or anything like that? Because I know you had... Yeah, well, anybody can respond. You know, I think you broke it up into three different levels. I'm mostly interested in the geriatric oncology group, the older age group. No, if you haven't done it, that's okay. I was just wondering if you had.
So I think the question was about whether you have any results for older Latinas and their screening rates. Yes.
It is possible that the Latino population is a relatively young population, so I don't know exactly how you're applying geriatric, but if it's 65 and older, then it starts to get a little sparse, and probably for San Diego, it would be too sparse to analyze, I'm just guessing.
Okay.
Because particularly, like, pap testing, the rates are higher than for other screening modalities, so it's a function of the age group you're looking at and the rate of screening within the population, and then the, of course, variability of the other covariates you're looking at.
And for pap tests, you did have a CLA at 7 years of age because that was the screening limit during this time period. So the 65 to 70 there would be a mini.
Dr. Banta and then Dr. Schiff.
I also enjoy using the CIS data. This might be a question more for you, Dr. Brown. One thing that people mentioned to me is the issue of people have cell phones and landlines. Would that make a big difference when you're looking at that ratio?
Yes, it definitely could. We are now conducting, beginning with the 2007 CHIS, we now have added a cell phone-only sample. That is, so we have a sample as a part of our main sample of adults who have only a cell phone and no landline. And we do find that with that population, there is a significant difference for a number of variables, so that the absence of them from the sample would create a bias in the sample. But that's true really for typically for younger people. It would not affect mammography rates probably. It would not affect colorectal cancer screening rates because those are older populations and less likely to have a high prevalence of having only a cell phone. We will be expanding that cell phone sample in our 2009 survey to be both much larger and then also to include adolescents and children. So it will not be just an adult-only sample. Dr. Schiff.
So, hi, Gordy Schiff. Actually, I want to plug another use of this survey. It's in the current issue of Medical Care. This is the Journal of the Section, who's sponsoring the session, where the researchers did a very nice look at people who are switching health insurance. You hear about uninsured, but in the course of a year, 2.3 million Californians switched health insurance, and it was associated with worse outcomes. It's a nice piece. There's actually extra copies of it. I have a few limited on Medical Care. This is the plug for one of our later sessions. So this is for the Donna Median Award, Dr. Brook from UCLA. So I'll just pass it out. I did have a couple of questions, though. One question actually relates to sort of the cost, and I may have missed this, I came in a little late, the cost benefit of the survey. The California survey. So one of the goals is to really empower community groups with data, with ammunition to help them. And, one wonders, whether investing directly in funding advocacy groups versus, and again, maybe it's not fair to say either or, one needs data to do advocacy. But I'd just be interested in some of your thoughts about that. I'm sure you must struggle with this all the time, both in terms of doing things quick and dirty, as well as, and then the other, and it sort of relates to this democratization of science, which traditionally that term was applied for sort of having people on the ground empowered to do community epidemiology, shoe leather epidemiology. And so I'd be interested in your sort of thinking about some of those issues, sort of as challenges to sort of how we do a community-oriented advocacy and data. And I guess this is somewhat of a different question, but related. What does it mean that 1 million people are going to lose their homes the next year in terms of losing addresses, both for collecting data, for them being able to be enrolled in healthcare and have a health insurance source of stability? And you must deal with this sort of transient population set of issues already. And so what are the implications of this sort of worsening crisis, for lack of a better word?
Those are a lot of questions to respond to. I'll try to address as many of them as I can. With respect to, let me address the first one you raised, and then maybe, if I may, put two of our major funders on the spot to offer their comments on it. But I think that CHIS data have proven to be cost-effective in terms of the engagement of many advocacy groups, giving them tools with which to be able to participate more effectively in the policy process, to make their case more strongly because they can make it with actual evidence or data. And they tell us that they find that very valuable. And in many cases, they tell us that it wouldn't be possible to make the strong cases they make as advocates without those data. But our survey is designed not only to serve advocates, but also to serve policymakers and to give them the support, particularly at the local level. At the state level, there are other surveys available. They may not provide the same depth or comprehensiveness as CHIS, but there are data sources. At the local level, there's very little data, and there's certainly very little data that's comparable unless you're using administrative data or vital statistics data. And those are very limited, and they, of course, don't capture the population that never gets access to the healthcare system or that is overlooked in some other way. I think that there is a need for funding both advocacy and the data that advocates use. And I will say, although no one from the California Endowment is here, that that is the strategy the California Endowment has used. So they have resources that they make grants totaling about $180 million a year in California, and a significant portion, I don't know what share, but a significant portion go directly to community-based health programs and services and advocacy groups. But they also are generous funders of CHIS, and they tell us that they do that because the data are critical to their grantees. So that's the evidence that we have with respect to that. And I don't know if Dr. Horton, from the perspective of a state agency that's one of the partners in CHIS and is a major funder, or Dr. Breen from the National Cancer Institute perspective would want to comment on this.
Well, I would just reiterate what Rick said in terms of NCI would like the division that Selma and I work in is the Division of Cancer Control and Population Sciences. And so we feel it's important to have an evidence base, a strong evidence base from which everybody can at least debate about the facts rather than debate the facts. Because if you don't have evidence, if you don't have information, factual information, then people don't have a basis on which to decide their, you know, discuss and decide their perspectives. They're rather saying, well, how many people are uninsured? The kinds of questions that Rick was talking about before. So in order for policymakers, advocates, the public, healthcare providers, for all these different groups to be able to speak, communicate effectively, we feel it's important to have an evidence base. So that's our approach to this.
Mark?
Not much to add except to reinforce those very statements. I mean, obviously, the Department of Public Health is very significantly invested in the process and sees not only the value to individual programs and policy development, but I think meets the need for public empowerment and to have access to the kind of data that that can help us understand the impact of programs and policies on our population as a whole and see what the real problems are. So I think it's a huge investment for us.
You know, just to give you one small example, Gordy, the health officer in Humboldt County, population 800,000, is an avid user of CHIS data in her work, and she uses it to bring the attention of the Board of Supervisors to problems of obesity, to food insecurity, to poor diets, to physical activity and inactivity issues in her county, and issues of asthma as well. So, you know, the data are really actively used by local health departments that have no other source of data, as well as by advocacy groups for underserved and disadvantaged populations. Dr. Ponce. Just an elaboration of that point, why does CHIS have a large Asian and Pacific Islander sample, and why do we conduct the survey in Mandarin, Cantonese, Vietnamese, and Korean? It isn't just because, you know, I thought it was a good idea when we were developing the survey. It's because Asian and Pacific Islander advocacy groups were banging on the door, banging fists on the table, and they were at the table, and they were making it very clear that this was an important objective that needed to be met by this survey. And it really led to a shaping of the sample design of the survey and the sample size, and the investment in substantial in-language capability in the survey. So I think it is really true that advocates have been there from the beginning in the very planning and development process at CHIS, and they're there in every cycle. And as Dr. Ponce said, I mean, I will tell you, we had a measure of racial and ethnic discrimination in CHIS in 2001. We got incredibly low incidence rate from those data. I thought the data were lousy. I thought the measure was lousy. And I said, there's no point in us continuing this. We shouldn't even be releasing this. And what the technical advisory committee said was, we don't want you to simply dismiss this issue. Because there may not be a good measure, that's not good enough. You have to go out and develop better measures of it. And Dr. Breen was a part of that process and heard that. And, you know, they were very persistent in those demands on the survey. And so there was a response to that. Christy?
Yeah, I work.
Christy also works on the survey. Mark? Mark?
Rick, one of the questions I had was, and I was trying to formulate how to best ask this, but there's a lot of discussion at this meeting about social determinants of mm-hmm. health. And we heard a presentation today that from Rear Admiral Raleigh, who's head of the Office of Disease Prevention, Health Promotion, indicating that there's going to be a new framework for healthy people 2020. I mean, I'm very impressed with the number of demographic characteristics mm-hmm. that are. But I guess the question is, do you think you're adequately positioned in order to address a new framework for looking at health through social determinants for the cluster of things? Do you need to rethink that, add certain determinants to the things that you're collecting, to be able to adequately monitor going forward from in a social determinants framework?
That's a very good question, and I don't think we are adequately in a position to do that. I think we are trying to add new questions on social determinants. One of the problems we face is that there is not very good consensus in the field of research on which social determinants really are determinative of health outcomes. And so it's a research field that's in development, and presumably as that develops and more findings become sort of gain a consensus, that there will be more opportunities to kind of add very targeted social determinant measures. We are trying to add some on social capital, which we have had in the past. We have found kind of mixed results in terms of their actual quantitative effect on health outcomes, but we have identified a number that seem to be important across more than one health outcome. The other aspect of CHIS that I think is valuable in social determinants is that we don't have to get all of the information from the survey and from the respondent themselves, because CHIS data are all geocoded to the exact location of the residence of the respondent, and for school children to the exact location of their school. And therefore, we can also use external data sources on things like location of parks, urban design, crime statistics, deterioration of housing, age of housing, location of grocery stores, location of fast food restaurants, to understand the relationship between the health behaviors of individuals and the environments they live in and go to school in. We are using the data in those ways now, and we're finding it very interesting and productive, and they have actually contributed to policy change. As an example of that, a recent study we did with the California Center for Public Health Advocacy and Policy Link identified the density of fast food restaurants within an area that people live in as a factor relevant to their diets, and how much fast food they ate, how many fruits and vegetables, etc., and to their obesity. And we then used those data in a request from the LA City Attorney's Office to do some analyses relevant to LA City and South Los Angeles specifically. They then used those data to help justify a new ordinance banning new fast food restaurants in South LA. And so the data have been played a useful supportive role in that process. So I think that adding more measures of social determinants will be important, and also conducting geospatial analyses to link these data to other data sources will be critical in this factor, in this process. I think we have time for one more question. Dr. Smith?
How do you disseminate the information from geospatial data? Do people have to get a report from you?
The data, the study is in a policy brief, which our center disseminated, which got quite a bit of press, particularly in California, but some national press as well, and got wide currency. The data, that same policy brief is being disseminated not only by our center, but by Policy Link, by the Center for Public Health Advocacy, and that expands the reach of dissemination. Well, we make the data available, but we don't make that analysis itself. I mean, there's not raw data there. It's a set of findings from a study, and those are in a policy brief. Well, I want to thank you all very much for coming, and encourage you to, for those of you who haven't tried AskChis or aren't CHIS users, I encourage you to do so. And I'd also like to just acknowledge Dr. Elaine Zond, who came in, who is also one of our partners in crime. Oh, well, thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Martin, give me that. Yeah, one and one. One and one. Hey, just come on in.
It's a follow-up phone call. We get a report every month.
bear some similarities to traditional omnibus surveys. Some similarities, right, where people buy in questions on it. Well, I was thinking of like the North Omnibus Survey or the University of Michigan Omnibus Survey that they did for the universe. You know, you could say, here's the money, I want these 12 questions, and I get the base data plus the 12 questions. No. Here's more control than that. The other distinction, and it's worth just describing this to see how it fits in. The other distinction is that those were all designed as general population. In other words, the population was the population. They made no effort, at least through most of their history, to try to get information about something. And so your design structure, your sampling structure, is different also in response to the technology. Now, when you convene a group, how do you frame a charge? Do you say, we're going to talk about smoking, or do you say, we're going to talk about...
The CHIP advisory board.
Yeah.